No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God. Hello and welcome back to the Fear of God podcast. Find all of your favorite foggy paraphernalia, like how to join us on Patreon, at thefearofgodpodcast.com. That is thefearofgodpodcast.com. Every week here in the fog, we explore what scares us to find what saves us. And by we, I mean me, one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse.
And me, your other host, Reed Lackey.
Reed!
Hey, man.
Welcome, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you?
I'm here. And
that feels like a common answer for you lately.
Is that kind of year?
Yeah. I get it.
You know what's crazy, Riri, is since last we did this, you and I were together IRL.
It's true. Oh, man. It was so great to get to see you for like a literal hour, but it was still awesome.
It was tough.
It was still great. No, that's you can't. You literally flew out, had lunch with me, and then flew back that night. Right? Like that was it.
Yeah. That's. I might would have saved myself a little bit of later travel trouble had I done that. But no, that is not quite how simply it went. But no, it was lovely to see you and your family and to experience some of that chilly and wet SoCal. You know, spring.
I felt the need to apologize, even though I have no control over the weather.
Sure.
It's like, Southern California has this reputation that we're always sunny. I'm looking out right now. It's 71 degrees outside. It is blue skies, very bright, no wind, but not
very
when you came.
Very different than it was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Not when you came. They're like, oh, East Coasters are coming. So we need to, we need to figure something different out.
Yeah. They didn't spend way too much money getting here and hanging out.
Wow, and you are not bitter about it at all.
Oh man. No, only two of our brood came home sick. Riri, today we are cranking up the electricity for a series. Frankly, if I'm not mistaken, it's in my fog persona's honor, right?
It is. It's all about you. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate I was finally getting around to that statement.
Waiting for years.
Hey, do me a favor.
Okay.
And because I know this particular had a burning interest, you know, like bolts to the neck, you had an interest in kind of jumping into some, you know, maybe some thematic waters, maybe some particular films. Tell the listeners about what we're going to be doing these next few weeks. And then we're going to do a little business time, to catch up on some 2023 business.
Yeah, of course. So I had noticed last year that the novel from the early 1800s, 1818 specifically, Frankenstein by Mary Shelley was having a bit of a moment. There were, at least by my recollection, there were four films that all came out inside of a year that had some version of Frankenstein as its DNA, directly analog. And so it just fascinated me. And also, each of these four films were, you know, kind of also centering around social issues, conversations around specifically like gender and femininity, which was interesting because, of course, Frankenstein was written by a woman, Mary Shelley. And so I just thought, wow, why don't we take this opportunity to just examine at least a few of those films? So we're not doing all of them. We're looking at three films over the course of the next 3 weeks. We're going to be looking at the films that have been kind of inspired by Frankenstein. And to kick things off, we're going to look at an adaptation of the original story, just to kind of give us some shared language, a shared template. We're not going to be reading the novel along the way, but figure just getting the core story in our head as we look for how other films have remixed it could be advantageous to us. But I'm very curious, interested, and excited to see kind of what conversations emerge out of this. I'm fascinated by the fact that Frankenstein's having a moment.
And to your point, to be explicit about it, today we are specifically, plugging in to 1994's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, directed by Gilderoy Lockhart himself, one Mr. Kenneth Branagh. So we'll be talking about that film here in just a few minutes. But before we do that, Reed,
yes,
we're working really hard, if you haven't noticed, to keep 2024 from starting. Like, I am, it is
severely,
it's gonna be a year, y'all.
Yeah, so I'm afraid
we oh yeah, 2023, we just wrapped up last week. In fact, we did a wrap up of a wrap up, right? So yeah, we'd already more or less completed our 2023 look back, and then
epilogue
did,
wrap up.
No yeah. One Will Save You. Mm-hmm. A wrap up there. And right now we're going to be breaking down the listener voted top 10 horror of 2023. We do this every year. Mm-hmm. And this year is going to be no different. So
that's right.
That is how we're going to spend the next few minutes before we jump into Mary Shelley's
Frankenstein. Get into the shocking truth of the story. So a little bit of a setup/context for this. We toyed with the notion of revealing this listener voted list, which was voted on months ago, to be clear. But we toyed with the notion of doing that at the dawn of the series. But there were a handful of films that were on the list that we were covering that you had not seen yet. And so I'm going to be very curious as we make our way through this to, hear some of your thoughts. Some of them we have already covered. I think of the top 10, we have covered every film on the list except for two of them. So, which, we presumably will at some point in The Fear of God get to those other two. But as you glance over the list, that's the top 10, which we'll get to in a second. But there was also a long sort of tail of a bunch of films that didn't quite make the cut. So my question to you, to kind of kick things off, is there a film that did not make its way into the top 10 that we either did or didn't cover that you would highlight and say like, oh, that's interesting, or I really enjoyed that more than I thought I would, or I didn't like that, whatever you would say.
Of this honorable mentions list, I'll name one that I might cite as my own honorable mention, and then one that I saw and would maybe not cite. So the one I did see and probably wouldn't cite, I did see Infinity Pool. I don't know why I keep doing this to myself with Brandon Cronenberg's material, which is actually no shade to him. It's more just at this point, maybe a taste thing. I think sometimes I want to be cooler than I am and hang with the, cool. The heavy,
I'm just saying,
kind of hang with the big kids, at the big kids horror table and
at the big kids infinity pool.
There's a lot swimming around in that infinity pool that is probably not worth, dipping your toes in. Indeed. So I did watch it kind of on a lark, sometime last year. Here's what's hard about that movie is I actually kind of dig its sort of general plotting and style. Mm-hmm. It's just it gets kind of like possessor before it.
Yeah.
It just in places steers super hard into some super dark, rancid places.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to like, I'm mentioning it.
Sure, because it's an honorable mention. Yes, indeed.
Sure, but that's about the sum of it. The one I would cite, kind of maybe has crept up my affection list due to some recency bias here, perhaps, but Beau Is Afraid. I just found it charming for what it is, weird and definitively weird, but kind of one of those that really stood out after the fact as I kind of survey what I did see from 2023.
Yeah. Sure.
What about you?
I think I'll do the same, except, mine will both be, affectionate, but both of these films were films I was just kind of okay on. I was like, oh, those are fine. until I rewatched them for our conversation. And the combination of rewatching them with intent to cover them and the subsequent conversations really elevated both of these films for me. They didn't make the top 10, but I'll cite them both and then just sort of package them together so we can actually get to the top 10. But the two I would honorable mention would be No One Will Save You, which we just talked about last week, and Skinamarink. Both of those films, my first viewing had some appreciation, some enjoyment, but definitely not something that I would have cited as like, oh, that film really interested or energized me. But when, for each of them, and for vastly different reasons, when I rewatched them, I gained a pretty sizable appreciation for each of them in turn. And I loved, again, for different reasons, but absolutely loved each of those two conversations. I thought our conversation around Skinamarink was one of my favorites that we've had in a really, really long time. Sure. I just loved diving into some of that concept of toying around with the form and what that does to us as viewers when the form is so dramatically, you know, sort of upended. And I just really appreciate the theological ramifications that we went to in that conversation, just a real warm sort of sensibility of the power of film and the power of storytelling that it can have on us. And again, a bit of recency bias myself. Last week's conversation on No One Will Save You, I just loved that one so much because I kind of love it when it's not awkward or tense, but we're kind of in different places and we can explore and unpack those ideas in the safety of friendship and being able to kind of figure out in better and more refined ways why we feel the way that we do. So yeah, I would cite as honorable mentions, they did not make the list. None of the films we've mentioned have, but No One Will Save You and Skinamarink for me. I'm very appreciative of both of those films. Do you mind? I'm skimming the list right here, and I do have a reason for doing this, but do you mind if I take evens and you take odds and you get to cite the number one?
I don't mind.
All right. So I'm going to kick us off with number 10. So this is the listener voted top 10 horror films of 2023. And number 10 is a film we have not covered. And I do not know if you have seen it or not. Oh, okay. So the film, which was most famous for its supporting player, and that is Renfield, which is co-starring Nicolas Cage as Count Dracula. I did, for what it was, have a lot of fun with this one. I suspect in the, you know, months, maybe years, but at some point in the future, we will cover Renfield. So, but for the sake of you who have not seen it, I will simply say, like, it's perfectly fine. I will say that upon first viewing, the very obvious poster, like, best thing about it is Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage is the reason to watch that movie. Like, people may love any number of other things about it or not, but Nicolas Cage as Dracula is the reason to watch that movie. And he delivers. Even if you walk away being like, that movie sucked, I think you will agree that Nicolas Cage is just having so much fun doing his thing, which, you know, we spent a whole series on Nicolas Cage, yeah. So my affection for him is well noted. But yeah, Renfield came
maybe,
in at number
maybe,
10.
Maybe another Cage series of Renfield, Ghost Rider 2, and...
oh boy.
Dream scenario.
We will call that the goodbye listeners. And actually, I liked Dream Scenario a lot. But anyway, okay.
Oh yeah, so. I love Dream Scenario. I think... I actually was enthused about Renfield, and then it did, to an allusion you just made, get kind of middling reviews, which made me a little sad, because I like Nicholas Hoult a lot, but, you know,
yeah,
Cage
yeah.
is always a good hang, and conceptually it looked pretty fun.
Sure.
Number 9, which we covered just a few weeks ago with a friend of the fog, Vera Gowdy, that is Totally Killer. Fun little 80s throwback romp with a great script and some really funny gags to it.
Love it. Yeah, that was great. That was another conversation I was really appreciative of. Landing listeners' favorites at number 8, Nathan hates this film. This is...
Stop! Oh my gosh.
Just kidding. It's Cocaine Bear, everybody. It is Cocaine Bear. And that landed at number 8. I don't feel the need to either, despite my little jokiness a second ago, to either you know, further interrogate your opinion on it. I will just say, like we said on the episode, you kind of know what you're going in for, and if you get the joke and if you enjoy the joke, Cocaine Bear will probably be your thing. If you don't, it probably won't be. But it was for a lot of people, at least enough people to land at number 8, Cocaine Bear.
To be clear, and for the record, I do not hate Cocaine Bear. It is just not, you know, it's not on my top 10. That's all.
Yeah.
Okay. It's on the Fog top 10. Number 7, this would be on my top 10, and in fact, would probably be a good bit higher. And that is the 6th and maybe final for the moment. Scream 6, that is. What a just, golly, talk about just watching shit fall apart in real time.
It was one of the weirdest, like, the franchise, like, where it started and how it's going kind of thing. Like, it's like, oh my god, it was, yeah. Did you hear, I guess the latest is that they do have Neve Campbell back for Scream 7. I don't know if that was a rumor or confirmed, but I heard that.
I saw it as a, like, you know, we're working on this. I don't know that I'd seen it as a firm.
Gotcha.
I even saw a Melissa Barrera, you know, quote the other day of like, never say never. I'm like, yeah, man, you know, some conversations are happening.
Absolutely.
To attempt to patch this back together.
Yeah.
Whether it will or not remains to be seen. But it, you know, I for one, decisively enjoy 5 and 6, and 6 was last year and is number 7.
Yeah.
On the absolutely. Top 10 listener horror of 23.
It's one of my favorites in the Scream franchise, and that's saying a lot with my affection for that series. But number 6 is a film that I loved so much. We have not covered this yet. I'm excited for the chance that we get eventually to cover it. This is a film I loved so much that I received a screener for it. And then after I saw the screener for it, I was like, nah, I gotta go see this in the theater. So I watched it by screener, and then watched it, went, paid my money, and saw it in the theater. Number 6 is Godzilla Minus One. I'm endeared tremendously by the fact that this film has made such waves. I think the film is solid. I think the film is, I would even say, great. And I loved many things about it. But it's not that the film necessarily is just like, oh man, it deserves to be at the top of the heap of all this stuff. You know, it's got its problems like all films kind of do. But I just love its spirit. I love it's got a kind of a plucky vibe to it. They really just cracked a very important code for making a solid Godzilla movie. And I just love how fans embraced it and just gave it legs, and it's a really great movie, and so I just love the heck out of it. But Godzilla Minus One landed at number 6, which made me really happy.
Yeah, I'm honestly anxious to revisit it, because I think for me, when I saw it, I did see it in the theater, Jackson Harper and myself and another buddy here locally, both fatigue and overhype might have combined to create a struggle. Sure. But it's hard to, whatever malformed quibbles I might have, there is no arguing the scale and scope, and sort of, to even use the word blockbuster feels like you're underselling how effective they pull off the vision of how Godzilla functions in the film. It's pretty dang impressive.
Yeah, it's wonderful stuff. And Oscar-winning Godzilla Minus One. That's amazing. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of minus ones, you got a Bo is Afraid, you know, build a phallus.
Wow. Yes. Sure.
Editor's note: go listen to the Bo is Afraid conversation. Number 5 on the list. This would have definitively been in my top 5 had I crafted my own personal one here, and that is Evil Dead Arise. Evil Dead Rise. last year's Evil Dead entry that, you know, kind of is a little less cheeky, campy than the series is typically known for. I responded quite well to it, both in the theater and then rewatching it for this. I think its tone, its vibe, I really just got on the wavelength of, and would welcome further installments with this creative team were that to happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really dug Evil Dead Rise. Go listen to that episode. It's a fun one. Okay, number four is another episode, another conversation that we've had here that I was extremely proud of the episode, extremely proud of the conversation, and appreciated the film more as a result of it. Number four is Megan, which I'm not surprised to see it rise this high, because I think that's a little bit of not necessarily its quality, but how many people saw it. I mean, I know a ton of people watched that movie because it is PG-13, a little bit more accessible horror. But after our conversation, especially, like I really found the movie to be smarter than I thought it was the first time through. And I am genuinely eager to see sequels to Megan, and to see where they take that concept and where they take the scenarios from here. So, yep, number four was Megan.
Number three on this list, our first conversation of the year, our first entry in our look back series. The last time we had the Van Ryder fellas on, as well as Matt Gory Gamer Murray, and that is When Evil Lurks, starring the one and only brand new mascot to the Fear of God, Leaky Boy.
Leaky Boy.
He was a hit.
Man. Little head bobbing up there.
Bit of a drip, if you know what I mean. But pretty much When Evil Lurks is worth liking across the board, aspects of it worth loving. To me, gets a little lost in its mythology by the end of it, but that doesn't dilute its effectiveness in a general sense. But yeah, it makes total sense why it's as high on the list as it is.
Yeah, it was actually my number one, and that's even with some of the quibbles that I did and would acknowledge against, you know, to your point, some of the mythology, some of the tone, but no, I thought When Evil Lurks was fantastic. It was no film.
I mean, you won't look at the family dog the same again anytime
soon. No horror movie last year arrested my attention and imagination as much as When Evil Lurks did. I absolutely love that film. Yes, go listen to that episode if you want to hear our further thoughts on that. Number two sincerely surprised me that it made it this high. And part of that is because of my feelings about it and kind of the tone of the conversation that we had around it. It was not one that we covered during this run in 2024. But number two, M. Night Shyamalan's latest, Knock at the Cabin, made it all the way up to number two. And I do find that fascinating. It's amazing to me that that film connected with as many people as it did, as strongly as it did. Because I thought that the opinions on it were more broadly polarizing, which, you know, maybe in the grander global scale it is, but I did find that really fascinating, and it's a film that still sits kind of in a strange place in my heart. This huge affection that I have for Shyamalan, some uneven feelings about Knock at the Cabin itself, while simultaneously feeling that the craft involved in Knock at the Cabin is just exceptional, and loving, you know, things like Dave Bautista's performance. And so, yeah, it's really, really interesting to me. But listener voted number two, Knock at the Cabin.
Hmm. That's that. All right. No.
Moving on.
Number one. No. I want to be fair here. So, in the same way that I don't hate Cocaine Bear, I don't hate Knock at the Cabin. I find, to your point, its craft pretty exceptional, especially set against Shyamalan's broader oeuvre. And performances and craft are exceptional. I really struggle with its thematics, kind of full stop. Sure. Whether I'm interpreting them correctly or not is a whole other conversation. Yeah. Nonetheless, number one on the list makes total sense. It is. Inspired the first Fear of God film, you know, action figure series, you know, with Bath Time Rally, Bedtime Rally. It is A24's Talk to Me.
Talk to Me. You know, it's quite interesting. Yeah.
What?
It's interesting. You know, the sequel to that has like the number two in the Talk to Me, which I just think is really, really funny. But I really thought that
are you being serious?
Yeah, at least that was the, I mean, when they greenlit the sequel, I saw like Talk with the number two, Me, and I was like, I don't know if they'll maintain that, but I really do think there was a missed opportunity to basically kind of take that premise and then go, you just kind of get really out of the box. And if you go to another, you know, that maybe they could talk about how a cyclone hit a, you know, waste disposal plant, and then, you know, it would create like this big shitstorm, you know, and like, and then they could call the film Talk Dirty to Me. You know, that would be,
wow, okay. Yeah. Yeah. These were new shoes. Talk Dirty to Me.
Talk Dirty to Me.
Or just, it's right there. Talk to Me too. T-O-O. It's like, you know,
Talk to Me
something
too.
Something about a lonely person out there. Talk to Me too.
Part five is like, I'm over here.
Like, please, somebody. Talk to me.
Answer the damn phone. That's number six.
I've been trying to shake your hand for five movies.
Like, will you please talk to me?
Talk dirty to me. Wow.
That
was some work.
It was some work. You know what? I thought about it in the moment. Like, well, appreciate it. You know, I was like, okay. Yeah. All right. So that was the listener voted top 10 horror of 2023. You ready to, you know, assemble some body parts and
fire it up.
Oh, okay. So for those of you who may not know, the novel Frankenstein is about a brilliant but unorthodox scientist named Dr. Victor Frankenstein. And he is a person who rejects the notion that man is resigned to death. He has a brilliant mind. He studies science and chemistry and determines a way to be able to reanimate a dead body. And when he does that, as you can probably imagine, things go poorly. That's what Frankenstein is about. You know, Dracula and Frankenstein, which we've talked about the Universal 1931 films before, Dracula and Frankenstein have been, I think rightly so, considered the tent poles of horror literature. Like, this is so many things, so many concepts, so many remixes owe themselves to, I'll stick with Frankenstein. Like, the idea and the ideas present in Frankenstein are almost mythic. Like Mary Shelley, I think, it was undeniably a genius in even just being able to craft this one singular story that holds so much imaginative power that, you know, literally a couple of centuries later, we are still finding new ways, as is inspiration for this podcast series we're doing right now, still finding new ways to remix the idea, remix the concepts, use the overlay of this story to try to express some things about us and about who we are. I mean, there would be no Jurassic Park if it was not for Frankenstein. There would be no The Terminator if it was not for Frankenstein. Like, so much of the idea of mankind taking their ambition too far. But specific to this film, so obviously there have been innumerable versions. Thomas Edison, for crying out loud, directed an adaptation of Frankenstein.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can watch it. You can pull it up on YouTube and watch it right now. Thomas Edison's Frankenstein. But in 1992, Francis Ford Coppola directed Bram Stoker's Dracula. And it starred Gary Oldman as Dracula and a whole host of other famous people. Winona Ryder is in it. Maybe we'll get to Keanu. That at some point. Yeah, Keanu is in it. Yep. And so Bram Stoker's Dracula was a massive hit. I think it was very successful at the box office. And shortly thereafter, I think this was something where the studios were pushing based upon the energy around the response Dracula got. They were like, ooh, let's do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So we did Bram Stoker's Dracula. We're going to do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And one of the screenwriters on this, so an individual by the name of Steph Lady had written the first draft of what would become Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but then it was doctored up by none other than Frank Darabont. I don't know if you knew that or not, but
I did.
And then Kenneth Branagh got attached to it, and that is the film that we are discussing today. Is Kenneth Branagh's directed Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It's my understanding you had never seen this film. Is that true?
Oh, can I speak now?
No, no, no. I've got more to say.
Oh, that's right. You did just answer the question.
Yes or no? Yes.
I mean, so I am truly your monster. Yeah, your creature, friend.
I was just setting up a bunch of stuff for you that I didn't want to insert later. I'm kidding. What'd you think about the film?
Well, before we get to that, is it safe to assume you have read the novel?
Yes. Yeah.
So yes, this was the first time I saw the film before any sort of takes or anything. Do you have enough of a familiarity at the ready from the text to know how closely the shape of this film follows it?
Yeah. Shape is appropriate. It's incredibly accurate. Well, not incredibly accurate. I shouldn't have given that adverb. So basically, I think that this film is regarded as one of the most faithful adaptations of the novel. It changes a lot. There's a whole subplot that they leave out where, like, Victor Frankenstein floats on a boat to another island and gets charged with murder. And like, there's this whole subplot.
But even just like the framing device of this Arctic expedition or whatever it is. Okay.
Yeah. And that is direct from the novel.
That was really throwing me.
Yeah. Okay. That's direct from the novel. So the novel is epistolary in form. So basically it's, you know, this guy, Walton, that we meet, he's played by, his name is escaping me. I'm fighting a cold, y'all. Forgive me. What's the guy who plays the captain of the boat? I know it. And I forgot. Aidan Quinn. So Aidan Quinn, that character in the novel, he is writing letters back home from that North Pole expedition. And so everything is kind of conveyed in letter form. And that's how all of this narrative kind of shakes out. But no, incredibly faithful. The stuff on the ice, the omission, the biggest omission is there's a whole subplot in the novel where Victor Frankenstein is framed somewhat accidentally, definitely charged with Clerval, his friend Clerval.
Yeah.
The creature kills Clerval in the novel, and Victor Frankenstein is charged with the murder. He is eventually acquitted of the murder. There's not evidence for it. But that whole subplot was excised from the film. Strangely, though, they added him reanimating Elizabeth at the end. That is not in the novel. That piece of it is not in the novel. Frankenstein's creation wanting a bride is in the novel, not Victor trying to reanimate his own wife after she died. So, other than that, it is highly faithful to the novel.
Yeah, I figured, you know, based on what I recollect of the original Universal film, it has a more of an intimacy to it than this. This is a bit more, you know, the scope is wider, the aperture is wider, and so I assumed it was likely that much of that was pulled from the text. So circling back around to your question of my feelings on 1994's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, directed by Kenneth Branagh. So I've made this reference before, but 2 years later in 1996, I was introduced to the work of Kenneth Branagh by way of his Hamlet. Starring Kate Winslet, Derek Jacobi, several other, Rufus Sewell, a bunch of folks. Robin Williams, I think. Is that the one where he and Billy Crystal are the gravediggers?
I don't know if they're the gravediggers. But anyway, that's not important. But Robin Williams is definitely in it. And I think Billy Crystal is too.
I'm pretty sure I'm right. But
you could be right.
That movie features instrumentally in my psyche. You know, for listeners specifically and especially patrons who listened to the House of Usher material and were introduced to our new character, the Fogophile, and his conceit of delicious words. It was in that same English class, Kathy Velhaber's English class, where I was exposed to this particular Hamlet film as a class. We went to go see it together. And so it just really became this, you know, this nucleus that a lot of my early, it's arguably one of the first films I took seriously from a film criticism standpoint. You know, it really just had this larger than life kind of impact on me. And to be fair, I haven't watched it in years. Having watched this Mary Shelley film makes me intrigued to kind of get back into that. So what is curious though about that is, despite this sort of long shadow that film, that particular film casts, I've never actually, you know, done the work of watching all of Branagh's material. You know, I've kind of got this built-in affection for him.
Yeah.
And I've seen kind of the major stuff but I've never, you know, stuff that I'd missed, or just that passed me by when it released, I've never really gone back to with intention. So he holds this kind of real curious, you know, sort of space in my, creative development.
Sure.
And so I was kind of looking forward to this. And in fact, you'll recall, but for listeners, you know, when the notion of this, Frankenstein series started taking shape, kind of threw this one in the pile of like, well, you know what? I kind of want to watch it. This is a good excuse for it. And in a lot of ways will thematically serve, you know, as a launch pad to some of the other stuff we're going to get into. So that's kind of a long preamble just to say, I kind of came predisposed to open-heartedness, know, and a kind of willingness and desire and interest in kind of letting it do whatever it might do. And there's a lot to kind of appreciate. It has this very, and I actually don't mean this derisively, it has this very kind of 90s period high. You can tell it's largely made with a classical point of view.
Oh, yes.
A la someone like Branagh at the helm. There are some curious decisions from a production standpoint. There's also some interesting decisions from a production standpoint. It was really fascinating to me to have my 17-year-old selves? My 17-year-old selves. Assessment and what Branagh held for me in that Hamlet film get put to the test a little bit for what several places in this film feel very self-indulgent and very showy and very, if we're being real direct here, very Gilderoy Lockhartian, in ways that I don't, that as a teenager, I wouldn't have picked up on, you know,
like,
okay, cool. A 10-minute sequence of you shirtless and sweaty. Yeah. That really makes sense in context of this story, but cool. We'll go for that. But what's really hilarious, Reed, and, you know, listeners can feel free to follow this rabbit trail if they want, but because I'd watched the film a little further ahead of time than I typically do, I wanted to kind of look for any, you know, or what I might be able to find of like interviews from that era.
Oh, okay.
And found on YouTube this, like, I'd have to look it up, but it is, or I'd have to, I don't remember the name of the woman, but it's, you know, presumably a film critic at the time, but she's interviewing Branagh, and it's real like lo-fi, like Wayne's World, closed circuit TV kind of energy to it.
Sure.
But Reed, she is like, and he's, I don't know exactly how old he was then, but let's say, you know, roughly 30. And if quite that, she's probably at the time in her late 40s, early 50s, and she is salivating so bad for your boy Branagh in this interview. Like, it's just this weird, like, and she's American. She's like, you know, it seems like America just really appreciates you a lot more than your home country. Why do you think that is? It's so like, and he's just, you know, Kenneth Branagh, and he's very handsome and flowy locks. And, you know, here's why I imagine it might be that people, you know, like it more here than there. And Brits are more staid and Americans are more free. You know, it's just this really funny token of an era, you know.
Yeah,
this,
of course.
Moment of an era. I promise I'll let you get back to this, back to talking about things, but the long tail to get back to the ice shelf with our creature here is just, I think I can hold this film as an interesting kind of throwback, and I don't think it's a bad film.
I
think what they were after was a masterpiece theater energy, and they more or less hit that, but I don't know that even it itself is that interested with some of its deeper themes, you know?
Agreed.
It's very narratively driven that way, very plot based that way. So anyway, that's a lot I'm throwing out there on the pile, but, kind of an answer to your question.
Yeah. Kenneth Branagh is a really interesting director because this same filmography that has 4-hour Hamlet also has Thor and, you know, Cinderella. And
I loved his Cinderella.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's interesting because it feels, with the exception of some thematic interests, it feels like there's a wide range of stylistic flourishes that he introduces in his films. For instance, his Hamlet is patient enough to adapt the entire play. It's a 4-hour film. The entire play without cutting some of the extraneous, like, military stuff that usually gets cut from adaptations. This film, Frankenstein, feels aggressively impatient. It feels like it cannot get to where we need to go fast enough. And part of my...
But wouldn't you say, I'm sorry to cut you off, wouldn't you say, though, now I have not looked at the behind-the-scenes crafting of his Hamlet, imagine it's largely auteur-driven, I imagine, very much a brainchild of his own, whereas this, it seems pretty clear from the behind-the-scenes stuff that there was, you know, kind of conflict between Coppola, him, you know, there was even Darabont, like, from a tonal standpoint, from a pace standpoint, it does not feel uniquely his in that way.
I agree with that, and some of the impression that I get from it is, I wonder if he wanted to make like a 3-hour Frankenstein movie, and they had to keep, now I don't know this because I wasn't able to, I didn't do a lot of digging, but the film felt to me like he wanted to make a 3-hour Frankenstein film, had to get into the cutting room area and had to chop out like whole sections. Cause when I tell you, like, you know, what's really interesting, I won't spend long on this, I promise. In 1992, same year that Bram Stoker's Dracula was released, there was a TNT, a made for TV movie starring Patrick Bergen and of all people, Randy Quaid as the creature that does this similar adaptation. It starts on the ice. It does that flow of things. They take more liberties with the novel than Branagh's film does. But I remember watching that on TV and being like, man, I didn't realize this was all there was to Frankenstein. And I think that might have largely driven me to read the novel. But then a couple years later, Branagh's film comes out. And it's not fair to Branagh's film to, you know, pivot it back to a movie that listeners may or may not have seen. But the adaptation I'm referring to takes its time. There's a lot more conversation between people. There's moments to breathe. I feel like this film has 3 moments in the entire film that you can take a breath. One of them, strangely, is when he and Robert De Niro are sliming around in the lab. You can take a breath for that one.
You can take a lot of breaths.
Yes.
You're wondering. Yes. What? Yeah.
Is this rest of the movie?
I don't think we did ignore themes. Here's your theme.
And it's just
mud wrestling with your monster.
Basically, you know that scene goes on for so long. But the rest of the film.
Okay, wait. You've got to set the stage. So the creature is alive. Finally,
it's alive.
It is stitched up. If I will give some credit to this film, I actually like the aesthetic of the creature in a general sense.
Oh,
the
me
design.
Too. Yeah, me too.
But I jokingly mentioned earlier, Branagh is like half naked for a large 20-minute run of the film. Mm-hmm. And in a way that really does not feel like it serves a story, right? There's nothing story-based about it. It is purely self-indulgent. He looks good and he knows it. Yes. And he wants to show it. And you have, to Reed's point, it is probably at least a minute, maybe 90 seconds to 2 minutes of... And Reed, in the back matter, it talks about it's gelatin. Like, this is a viscous element that they created. I even think it's boiled gelatin. I think I'm remembering this.
Oh.
But you've got half-naked Branagh, butt-naked De Niro, Bobby, and they are just flipping and flopping each other, Jell-O, Pudding Pop. It is just... It is a lot.
Oh, and my God.
You're like, okay. Is this why you made this movie?
every time they get to their feet, somebody slips again. And they're like, there's this one shot where poor Bobby De Niro has to, like, He's trying to like, he's trying to grab his face. I mean, it's just, it is the weirdest insertion in the middle of this. I know. And it's like that, to your point, that shot, we are not exaggerating. I think it at least a minute, maybe 90 seconds. But then the rest of it, I'm looking at all the rest of the shots through the film and they're just like, oh my God, they fast forwarded through, there's a cholera epidemic and now they're giving vaccines and now that guy died and now that guy, and it's like, oh my God, like all of that is just clip, 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 clip. Oh, let's pause here.
Yeah. And, let's drag give this one out.
Let's give friend. This one some, man said, friend. Oh my God. Like it's weird. It's weird. I do not understand that choice. And so,
well,
like, yeah,
I'm this is where we're just having fun here. But you talk about weird, Reed. I missed whatever scripting note there might have been at the beginning. Totally passed me by to understand that Helena Bonham Carter is not his biological sister.
Oh, yeah, that's so, a very brief scene in the movie.
The
very
bulk
early on
of the movie, I'm like, what? You know, I'm like, I feel like y'all think this is the weird part, but this is the weird part, you know?
Yeah.
To the point that I had to go read. I was like, I missed something. I don't know where it would be that I would have picked it up, but it's,
But no, not like this is me, you know, there may be sometimes in some films where I might jokingly be like, oh, you probably fell asleep. No, dude, you could be watching this movie, blink and miss it. It's the very first time after he's like, my name is Dr. Victor Frankenstein. And they go to Geneva and it's like they give the year for Geneva. I don't even remember what it is. It's that scene. The very thing. They're opening it up and his mom is sitting there dancing with young Victor Frankenstein. Right. And then the guy comes in and is like, she's going to be your new sister. Her parents died in this, I forget how they say it, but literally that's it. And that's the only context you get.
Yeah.
That they are not biologically related. It's wild.
So all you know is next they're referring to the same father and hugging and kissing in the field. You know,
you're right? Like, and I mean, like, but that speaks to, I mean, like I said, the film is paced. I think this film is paced very poorly. It feels very much like they are trying to squeeze so much information in that they just, it just keeps missing the audience. It keeps like all this different stuff. I was sitting there, I was
it's kind of like the audience is naked covered in bull jello and the movie is half naked Brenna. And we're just like, can we get connected and like, on our feet?
I am just trying to stand up, bro. Like, stop. Like, I am just trying to stand up. I can stand.
Someone give me a robe or something.
Give me
a towel.
Like, oh my God. It's just, it's weird. And there are, now that's the really head-scratching, jokey one. There are two other minutes in this. There's two other moments in this film that I would cite. One of the moments is when the creature is talking with the blind man and he's talking to him about how people perceive him and everything. That moment slows down. It breathes. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's nice. It lingers there for a second. You have a moment to catch your breath. And then there's another one later where I feel like when he finds Victor Frankenstein dead on the boat, like I feel like that, you know, the film kind of slows down a little bit. I am not speaking hyperbolically when I say, save for those three scenes, this film is just like, okay, we got to keep moving. We got to keep moving. Like, I can picture
when them Justine running around. Gets got, I was like, huh?
What? Yeah. Why? Wow. Yeah. It's like, you know, she's like, why'd they hang her? You know, like, it's just,
it's, they do not give you time to understand what's happening. Then she like, bye bye.
Yeah. She just falls right off. I mean, it's just, it is wild. And then literally, okay, that's a devastating moment. That character is pretty and demure, and you're like, okay, wow, why in the world did they hang this poor woman? The very next scene, did you get Justine? Yeah, we'll bury her later today. And then they're moving on, right?
Oh,
the,
yeah, like, yeah.
It's just, I mean, that really boggles my mind about this film. And that's why I say, I wonder, I sincerely wonder if he originally wanted to make maybe not a Hamlet length thing, but like a 3-hour Frankenstein, and then had to just
clip, I would clip, believe
clip,
it.
Clip, clip. Like, man, it is
okay,
frenetic.
Let's talk about another major point of this film before, and if we possibly get into any, you know, specific thematics we want to cover.
Sure.
And that is the De Niro of it all. I mean, because I'm genuinely cursed. Like, for me, it's largely fine, except when he speaks. I don't buy De Niro in this. And yeah. and there was some, there was a part of me even that, you know, Aidan Quinn as American, it was like, is this why they cast him? Like it stands out that everyone is speaking King's English.
Yeah. Right.
Except Brooklyn Bobby and Aidan Quinn. I mean, it just stands out. You have
to expect him to pull out a gun and cap somebody. Like, listen.
Well, when after Brenna has assembled his creature and they're done wrestling, I was waiting for Brooklyn, you know, Bobby. Brooklyn Bobby the creature to be like, I've got nipples. Can you milk me? You know, just like.
He's like, hey.
You.
Oh my God.
I even tried to disassociate myself a little bit. Like, okay, there's been, you know, 30 years since this and Bobby De Niro's, you know, looms large over the cinema landscape in that time. So I tried to sort of compartmentalize it that way. And then by the end of it, when he's speaking more fluently, I was like, no, it just...
Yeah.
You know, kind of physically, it kind of works visually, mm-hmm. but I just don't like what came to me, Reed, was Jeremy Irons. Why is Jeremy Irons not in this movie? Why is, oh, God, you
he
know,
would be great.
Right. Like, yeah. If you're gonna load up this cast with some of the at the time, hell, Hugh Bonneville shows up as just the thug in the street. Yeah. Like, what in the world? There's Daddy right. Downton Abbey right up in there.
Of course.
But, you know, it is just. You've got Ian Holm, like you just have big Brits kind of lighting up the screen.
Sure.
And then you got Brooklyn Bobby the creature.
Brooklyn Bobby.
It didn't really that part of it kind of I struggled with.
So I go back and forth about this subject broadly speaking. So I'm gonna come back to Brooklyn Bobby in just a second. We have covered on this show the version of A Christmas Carol starring George C. Scott. Because that is so much a staple of my childhood and because I am so fond and affectionate of that film, I was unaware until older that adaptation receives a decent chunk of criticism for George C. Scott not even trying a British accent. Doesn't even bother with it. The reason... besides nostalgia and childhood exposure to it, that it doesn't bother me is because George C. Scott's performance on an emotional level is so dang strong, you know, sure. Like because he just delivers on the emotion of it, I don't mind the absence of an accent. And I think that's a real tension in this film. I love the visual, to your point yes. earlier, like the way he looks standing there as the creature, because I don't know if you know this, not having read the novel. In the novel, the creature is like 8 feet tall because he has to be so big because Frankenstein couldn't get the proportions right. So he would use organs from animals and some of them were larger than human organs and everything. So he had to like, the creature winds up being massive, yeah. right?
Well, that makes sense.
Then I do think that to a degree, they try to visually represent that with some imposing shots of De Niro. And there are plenty of shots on there that I'm like, just freeze frame that. That looks fantastic. Like the stitched up appearance, that long flowing cloak. I'm like, that looks amazing. And in those couple of scenes that I mentioned where the film takes a moment to breathe, I even get pretty on board for the emotional performance that De Niro is giving. But so much of the film is just him. So much of his role of what the film asks of him is running around being threatening. And when he verbalizes being threatening, it's just like, you're talking to me. You're like, I mean, it's really, yeah. it's very, very unkempt, you know, like
to your George C. Scott comp there. I think for me where that sort of comparison struggles a bit, even though it makes sense, George C. Scott's Ebenezer Scrooge is a full theater performance. He is playing for the back row in the house, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't necessarily absolve the criticism. Well, why not do British while everyone else is?
Sure.
That's fair. But there's a, there's a artifice, there's a stylization to the performance that still renders it a bit left of standard American dialect kind of thing.
Right, right.
What is difficult with this is so much of the actual script provided for the creature is low and subtle.
Yeah.
And De Niro, low and subtle, is here. And, you know, you know, Victor from Geneva, I am here to kill you.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. That's
and then there's that really curious line is, you're going to give me a bride or I'm going to be with you on your wedding night. And it's like, hey, we're going to revisit Jello shots here, you know.
which to be clear, is from the novel, but still.
Sure,
coming
sure.
out of, you still, know. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. After the scene we already had, it, you're like, okay, that is what this movie is, you know. but yeah. That particular joke, and it's aside for the moment, because it will resume, I'm sure, in due time. The when he speaks, it is so subtle, it is so small that it's hard for him to not be. Like, to your point, we're effectively watching Cape Fear by the end of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, Victor. Come out wherever you are.
Oh, man. I'll meet you on the sea of ice.
And then he's got that super jump at the end. Like, whoa, man. We
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Now, that's the only time the movie it goes in slow motion, and it's still too fast. It's still like, whoa. Now, did he hit him? I couldn't see.
Here's what I will give some credit to, I think, although I'm open to a pushback here, like, the general style and look is strong, even oh, totally in places agree. That might not have dated super well. It still looks pretty legit, you oh, know.
I completely agree with that. Love the production.
And so, from that standpoint, it does hold up quite well.
I think a lot of the performances. The reason I get frustrated by the pacing is because I think a lot of the performances are really strong. I actually love what Helena Bonham Carter is doing in the role of Elizabeth. But I never get to see her for longer than like half a second in a shot, unless she's making out with Kenneth Branagh. You know, like there's so many of the shots that just like she's delivering something and then it cuts away from her too fast. Well, I take that back. When she's a reanimated corpse, they linger on it a little bit.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, just I feel like the performances in this are really strong and I would like to see more of that. But to your point about the De Niro of it all, like I don't mind it. Broadly speaking, and I think there are some moments where a better performance peeks through in a couple of quieter moments, but there's so much else busyness going on in the film that I do think it gets kind of overwhelmed. And then it's just, it's just a kind of a stew of all the rest of it. It's hard to really tap in.
And the struggle you encounter because the design of this creature is so unique set against the cinema canon of Frankenstein's monster is by the end of it, it does feel just like, you know, arch enemy, man against man, not man and his juggernaut creation.
Right.
You know?
Right. 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 Right.
So from that standpoint, it does fall into this weird, like thriller energy.
Sure. Yeah. But I do feel like, the other thing that kind of disappoints me about this film adaptation, I find it really, really fascinating the way this narrative toys around with how people reckon with death, and specifically death and ambition. The story of Frankenstein, what's really interesting is, if I'm remembering the novel correctly, it has been years, but if I'm remembering the novel correctly, near the end of the novel, when all the sailors want to go home, Victor Frankenstein tries to like give them a pep speech to keep going, like to keep on trying. And I'm like, have you learned nothing? Like, and this film directly pivots that to where he's like, you know, let me share my madness. So let me tell you my story so that you will learn from it. But I do feel like there's this weird thing happening in the story of Frankenstein where people desire so badly to achieve their goals, to achieve their ambitions, to achieve their dreams. Goals, ambitions, and dreams are all positive words. But when there's such a voracious kind of undiscerning ambition that drives you to not count the cost of what it is that you're doing. It fascinates me when I look around and think about things like the exponential curve of technological development. Like at this point, we are so in the world of internet and connectedness and AI that there's almost no pulling back from any of that. Political ramifications, the way certain ideas are now so far pushed to the extreme that being able to have a civil dialogue about that same subject feels almost impossible. Like you've now taken it to a place to where you can't ever come back from. And I feel like the story of Frankenstein is a testament to you have to be careful about what it is you are pursuing. I know it's in a different film, but it is very aptly written, so I'm going to quote it again. Jeff Goldblum's Ian Malcolm saying, "You're so busy worrying about whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think whether or not you should." And
there yeah. It is.
Nice callback. I love that. That was a yes and. So I don't know. It fascinates me. I'm trying to put my finger on, in case this is, where's Reed going with all of this? I'm trying to put my finger on why Frankenstein, the story, is having a moment right now. That's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. Oh, you there in the front.
So I pondered, now this is, I do not have a doctoral thesis written on this really big notion I'm about to throw in the mix here. And I pondered, you know, kind of how much to lean here in this opening entry, but it feels like we're more or less there. And so I'll unpack it a little bit, but you just said trying to suss out, okay, why is Frankenstein having a moment? Well, one of the reasons, once I knew the films you wanted to cover for this series, which none of which I've seen, but it's in some order to be announced, but Lisa Frankenstein, Angry Black Girl and Her Monster, and Birth Rebirth.
Yeah.
And why it made sense to me to start here. This is me speaking. Maybe it's new Fear of God speaking. You can affirm or reject this conceit if you so choose. You read. I'll frame it this way. I've referenced a couple of times over the last year or so the tech journalist Kara Swisher, who both her own solo podcast called On and a podcast she shares with a gentleman named Scott Galloway called Pivot. And honestly, how I came to listen to Kara Swisher was I was listening to Chris Hayes previously, who I still really enjoy, but Kara was on right around January 6th, and she just spoke with an urgency, a fervency that I was really impressed with. She is probably in her 50s. She is a lesbian. She's been a journalist for years and years and years. And there was a way where I was like, I need to listen to this person. I need to just be present in these conversations that aren't my point of view, because I need to hear alternate points of view. And this has just really become an interesting person I listen to since then with a lot of frequency. She, in assessing the Frankensteinian dynamic of tech bros and the digital monsters they've unleashed on society, your Zuckerbergs and Facebook, your Elons and now Twitter/X, and how much destruction those things cause. Her assessment, and one could call it cynical, one could call it biased, call it what you want, but I do think there's a grain of truth here, is people who have never felt unsafe have a hard time understanding when people feel unsafe. And so these people who are on the masthead of these massive global corporations whose tendrils wreak havoc in very literal senses at the bottom most, and it's creeping ever upward, because they just in their persona in the world have never really had to deal with transgression against them, don't understand that this could be a thing that's real and true. And so why it felt long-winded way to get back to Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frank is I love the performer Kenneth Branagh, as we've discussed. I love the sort of high Masterpiece Theater stylizing of this. But there's something about watching this now and seeing I hate to be this reductive. You, my friend, will understand it. And listeners who are with ears to hear will understand the sensitivity here. A rich white man. Like, has he suffered loss? Yes. But there's a difference between those with power and more or less who wield it, you know, kind of left and right, you know, at the top of a society.
Yeah.
We could say there might be some altruism to Victor's actions. At the same time, let's be honest, in the way that the film itself feels a bit self-indulgent to Sir Kenneth.
Yeah.
The story of Victor Frankenstein is the self-indulgent pursuit of a man who kind of has it all, saying, but what about this?
Right, right.
So to your question of why now, look at the protagonists of these coming tales. Mm. A young black girl and two women who it's the difference between having all the power and wanting more and having none and wanting any. And if I'm guessing correctly,
yeah,
these coming stories, these coming films aren't so much about let me crack the code on death itself and more, I can't accomplish safety in the ways I should and can and ought to. I need a golem to sort of present for me. And again, I'm being reductive to what I imagine the stories to be, but that's been on my mind a lot. As watching this film, as thinking through this coming series, and I am curious to see, am I conjecturing correctly at all of what's to come?
Oh, sure.
You know, sure. Of kind of what, just the difference between having it all and wanting a little more and having next to nothing and wanting something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. No, it does make sense. And I think the missing puzzle piece for me, not in making it make sense, but in sort of tying a bow on it, would be, let me talk about my perception of the outrage towards what is broadly referred to as woke. Do you mind if I go there? You're scared. just kidding. Here's what I think, and I'm talking specifically about the social outrage towards something like what gets labeled as woke. Functionally speaking, systems and people of power, to the point you just made, those people wield that power and it services them, it benefits them, their lives are not absent of struggle, but definitely not on the same plane of struggle as some other individuals further down the pipeline. Those individuals, over time and over culture, begin to push back, begin to lay out data, begin to make a compelling case for why things need to be more attended to. Things like racial injustice, gender inequities, those things need to be attended to. And then when, to your point, when people with nothing rise up for something, then there's this big pushback against giving them anything. Because right. They fear things will get out of hand. I'm not in this very second on this podcast making one case or another. I'm trying to diagnose the problem. That pendulum begins to swing back and forth and back and forth till pretty soon there are wide, wide canyons between the position over here and the position over here. So now what we sometimes see is anybody at all who raises their hand and says, hey, do you think we should do something about gender inequities in pay scales? And then everyone's up, it's stupid wokeness. No, we're not going to. And so the conversation just gets completely shut out, completely shut out. And regardless of whether you present compelling data for one side or another, suddenly battle lines are drawn. And now there's these extremities. I think about Frankenstein in this film and in the novel and in the 1931 version. And his conversation with the blind man, where he's there and you imagine for him a scenario in which it's like, regardless of what stitched him together, had he been met with any degree of compassion, kindness, and guidance, might not have made the choices that he made when those things play out that way. So what happens is, and I think this is pretty brilliant, what happens is, he is largely abandoned by everyone. So then whenever he finally makes this choice of like, okay, well, if I'm going to be abandoned by everybody, then I'm just in it for myself. I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to start taking people out. Like, I'm just going to, you know, fine. If you won't receive me, then I'm just going to start taking people out. And what's tragic about it is that the people who always saw Frankenstein's creation as a monster now feel more justified to call him monstrous. And what's missing is this component, the opportunity to be able to turn it one direction or another. And power is so addictive, and people don't want to give up power. And what I hate, this moment that I hate, is anytime a cause, a movement, a position, anytime there's any misstep, anytime there's anything that we would objectively look at and be like, okay, well, maybe that was a bridge too far, or maybe that statement was out of turn, it gives license for all these comfortable people in power to say, see, it's all just a shell game. It's throw the whole thing out, because see, look at what they said. That's one person said that one thing. Will you shut up for a minute and look at the problem and look at how many different factors play into what brought us here? And that's what I think is so compelling and tragic about it, is whether or not we're dealing with this massive societal outrage against a thing, the extremities feed upon each other and push each other to more and more polar extremes, when it all could have been avoided if people would just take a scale back and say, wait a second, what are we talking about here? What are we really trying to accomplish? What are we really trying to do? I don't know if I've made my point effectively or not, but I think about that a lot when I think about people who get, who grow very anti-woke, because they say like, well, I hate wokeness. And I get frustrated when I say like, do you even know what you are identifying that you hate about it? Because I think what you hate is irrational extremity. I don't think you actually hate the movement to treat people as people, and to make sure there's a more level playing field, and to make sure that there's more level opportunity and more level resources for everybody who needs them to thrive as a human being. I don't think you're necessarily opposed to that. You just hate these extremities that you've identified, and so you've thrown everything else out because of those extremities. Is that making sense, or am I tossing a word salad?
It's like you're trying to make a point, but the point is naked and colored in jello, and you just keep slipping and sliding, trying to get on your feet. It's trying to get on its feet. And
I figured, like, I was coming across that way.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think, listen, here's the thing, Lackey. You know, I'm trying to advocate that women and minorities should have some power. Those on top in our national discourse seem to suggest they should have none. You're trying to suggest that, you know, wokeness might be a mirage painted by propagandists, and let's maybe shut off one of our senses like the blind man and try to listen to each other. I think what I'm hearing is the fear of God, you know, 2024 has finally arrived. You know, we are here. We have cobbled together pieces of our 7-year past and turned ourselves into a golem set to wreak havoc.
And it is alive.
On behalf of the subaltern, as our patron Saint David Gushy would term those without a voice.
Can I
if
we are about to wind down the depths, which I'm content to do, but I do want to throw one more thing on there that may not require a ton of discussion, and that is not about social and political issues. Maybe it is to a degree. But the other thing that I am interested in looking at as we watch these next few films and in thinking about Frankenstein the narrative is what begins as, I would like to conquer death. I'll put it this way. A driving force for me is needing to be aware and comfortable with the fact that pain, suffering, loss, and eventually a version of death is part of the mix. It is not avoidable. It is not something that I will be able to float through the rest of my existence without some version of suffering, loss, pain. And I find it interesting that in this film, in this narrative, in this story, that what Victor originally seeks to try to do is just be like, nobody need die. Like he says that in the film. Blink and you miss it. But he says, you know, nobody ever, nobody needs to die again.
I love my sister.
Yes. He says it right after. I forget, before or after or something. And so, but he says, like, nobody ever has to die again. And when I was watching it through this time around, and obviously the Frankenstein story is very on my mind. We're doing a whole series about it. And I just thought about that. And I thought, like, man, we are so terrified of pain and of suffering that we will avoid it at all costs. We've talked for a few minutes about, you know, giving up power and how addictive power is. And I think the same could be true of comforts and the comfort that we seek to claim for ourselves and rest in for ourselves and say, like, okay, well, I want to avoid all pain. I want to avoid all loss, avoid all suffering. And it is meaningful to me to remember that the effort to escape pain and the effort to avoid it, instead of seeking to, I don't know what the word would be that I'm looking for, like recognize its value in our life, its teachable value to us. And if we, and I'm not saying like, oh, everybody should just suffer endlessly. Of course I'm not positing that. I just think that we're past the pandemic now. In 2020, we started off having a whole bunch of conversations about learning how to lose. And we're a few years into this, and it just hurts my heart that none of us have learned how to lose. None of us have learned how to be okay. We're so allergic to, like, no, I didn't lose. You know, I won. And that's in a whole bunch of different contexts other than just the obvious one that might come to mind when I say that. There's this notion of, like, to lose, I'll share this and then I promise I'm going to shut up and we can go somewhere else. My son right now is having a tough time because he's a preteen and he's having a tough time navigating complex emotions. He's having a tough time being hard on himself when he makes a bad decision. And the other night, he was kind of all stuck in a train of something, and without giving unnecessary context, he was deliberately disobedient to us. We had prepped him for something earlier. We then reminded him of the thing. When time came to do it, he was deliberately disobedient. And when we called him on it, and we didn't even do so like angrily, but when we called him on it, he began to spiral. He began to openly, tears just running down his face, saying things like, I am 12 years old. When am I going to do the right thing? I don't know how to not do the wrong thing. He said, it's so hard. And I told him in that moment, I tried my best to be comforting. And I told him in that moment, I said, it is always hard to do the right thing. It is always hard to make the better choice. It is always difficult. You never reach a place to where it's easy to do the good thing, the right thing, but you can reach a place over time where you get better at it, where you become better at doing it, and you have more resources, and you learn more, and you can just get a little better at doing it, but it's always difficult. And I won't rehash our whole conversation, but it's just been so on my heart this week. And relation to Frankenstein is this notion of thinking we can outwit all of the hard and difficult things instead of walking through them and recognizing the value that they may hold for our lives. And I'll go back to my earlier statement that it's just, after all this time, we still have not learned how to lose. And that is very on my mind as we enter into this series. Frankly, my dear. Yes, exactly. So, I didn't want us to leave the conversation, you know, without throwing that out there, I would have felt like I didn't acknowledge something that was very on my mind. And I'm sure will come up as we examine the next few films. But listen, I'm gonna do you a favor, okay?
Okay.
Unless you are dramatically opposed to it, I am not going to burden you with being my therapist and responding to me emotionally. I'm just going to express what I expressed about my heart and my grief and remind myself that we are a horror show.
Mm.
Did you know that?
Indeed.
That despite all this, we're a horror show. So listen, I just want to let you know that if it's gory, if it's gross, if it causes you a fright, what scares you about this movie? What makes you say, that ain't right?
That sure as hell ain't right.
Nathan, I'm going to let you go first. I talked a lot.
Okay. Just because I want it registered, we talked about honorable mentions during the horror top of 23.
Oh, sure.
Neither of us should probably name this as our utmost here, but it, like, partly because I just want our Vera, who works on our That Ain't Right social post,
right,
to have to source this somehow, is Jell-O Wrestling. With, you know, with Branagh and Bobby,
Jell-O Wrestling,
Brooklyn Bobby.
I called it yeah. Frank and his monster, slippy floppy dancing in all the viscous mucus.
Yes. Slippy floppy dancing. Yes. So, okay. I'll go for this one. I've got a one in mind, but we're running up against the clock here, and
okay,
we try to do just one of these. So, partly, here's a really funny trajectory on this story, on this film, is despite my general knowledge of the Frankenstein canon, you know, with the exception of, here's how you sneak in your runners up, with the exception of the jarring moment when you cut to Bilbo Baggins half naked and bloodied at his wife's nethers delivering a baby, I was like, what are we,
yeah, there's that.
What is happening right now? So other than that, the bulk of this movie, I was like, I mean, you know, it's horror themed and the monster is designed in a creepy fashion, but, you know, okay. I mean, this is kind of where we're at. And then your boy shows up and Mortal Kombat Kano's Bellatrix Lestrange's heart straight out of her chest on her wedding bed.
I was like,
oh my God.
Yeah,
you know, like this, like, I think I probably went slack jawed in that moment. You know, you talk about this thing being paced the way it is.
Yeah,
it was like, of course. He's here. He's on top of the bed. He's looking at her through the mesh. Suddenly his hands on her face. Suddenly his hands bursting through her chest. There's blood flying everywhere. And now it's pumping in his hand.
Wow.
And then he flips her off the bed and her head catches fire. Like, oh my God. We definitely are making up for some lost time in the horror movie category in that scene alone. It was wild.
It's so extreme. It's almost goofy where it's like,
oh yeah.
Like, yeah. I got her heart and it's like,
it looks like then, some Smuckers strawberry jelly popping out of her chest.
Man,
you know?
Said Smuckers. I got your Smuckers. Oh, man. And then, yeah, that's the thing. And then she flops off the bed.
Oh, yeah.
She flops off the bed right into the fire and, like, scorches her hair. It is a choice. It
they
is
planned
a
that
choice.
Out.
Choice.
That's like all, man. You know, Gage, or I'm sorry, Daddy Creed in Pet Cemetery, OG Pet Cemetery, flopping off the bed.
Oh, man. It is just, oh my gosh. Well, then, okay, this will be my That Ain't Right then.
Okay.
Because then you get, and this is not, again, this does not happen in the novel. She dies in the novel, and mm-hmm. she dies, you know, at the creature's hand. what's funny, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, he does a little, like, from the window, like, point to her corpse down at Frankenstein, who's, like, outside the house when he kills her. And it's, like, this weird sort of, like, I got her. It's the weirdest thing. That's actually in the novel. But what I'll cite as my That Ain't Right is that then this film chooses to have her be resurrected by Victor. And she's already, like,
she's a mess.
I waited for another Jell-O Wrestling moment, like, where it's like, okay, what are they doing? Like,
he,
you know, evidently he learned a thing or two because she's able to stand right up. There's no slip and slide and everything's fine.
He gets dressed.
Everything was fine. But then, like, he and the creature start this weird, like, tug of war over her, like, where it's like, no, 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 she's mine. Hey. She's mine. Like, and he's like, hey, you know. Right. And it's like, they start this weird, like, back and forth. And then finally she's like, no, you know, like this big, you know, hands out doing this big. And then she goes over, she takes this thing, the lantern, very similarly to what she had flopped off the bed and landed into.
Right.
But my that ain't right is like, I'm not going to lie. It's an impactful visual. But she like crushes the thing and it explodes like a grenade. Like it just, all the fire everywhere. And then she goes running down the hall.
Oh,
and this is what's wild. Like while she's running down the hall, evidently the wallpaper or the paint is the like super old and is like flammable. Cause it's like, it's popping as she's walking by. Like it's popping.
She got
flames.
A flower plant Mario style.
Oh my God. It is like, yes, it is just like, she is running down the hall, completely engorged in flames and everything. The walls are like exploding in flames around her. I'm like, holy cow. It's almost as if she was trying to say, I tried to tell you, this is how I'm supposed to die. I'm supposed to die with my head engulfed in flames. It is a choice. And it ain't right. That whole thing, like she, it's
what's wild is when it cuts back up to the two of them and they're just staring at each other and then they start mud wrestling again. And it's like, then they just grab a beer. Like, let's go get a beer. Hey, Victor from Geneva.
Victor from Geneva.
Remember what I said earlier? I got nipples. Can you milk me?
Oh my God. It was, it's strange. It was,
would you call it?
It ain't right.
That ain't right.
I would.
That sure as hell ain't right.
Oh, man. Okay, well, listen. We haven't talked about a ton of the interior specifics of the film, but we wanted to get some shared language before we dive into our next four films. I feel like we've pretty effectively done that. So it is time now for our fog meter, our way in which we rate the media that we cover on a unique metric, unique to our show, of fear and God, where we gauge not the quality of the films, but the gravity of the films, what they ask or demand of you as the viewer. And we do that by looking at fear, which is, you know, gory, nasty, gross, disturbing, unhinged, and God, which is what the film has on its mind and how effectively it conveys that. So I'm going to start with you. Why don't you give me both your fear and your God measurement for 1994's Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
There's a lot of possessiveness there. the 20th century's 1994's... Universal Studios,
Brooklyn
Mary
Bobbies.
Shelley's, Kenneth Branagh's, Brooklyn Bobbies. No, Frankenstein starring Brooklyn Bobbies, creature. Fear and God. I don't find this a scary movie. I think its creature design is great. I think those last 10 minutes do elevate the horror meter. So I think I'll probably land at about... a four feels
okay,
pretty appropriate there. Not really scary, but for someone who might really have no idea going into this, which would be uncharacteristic, but their first thing they're going to be afraid of is they siblings. The second thing they're going to be like, oh snap, he took her heart out.
Oh, they will. There was some terror in the Jell-O wrestling, I think, as
That's true.
But, I'm not far off from you. I was going to give it a 5 on the fear measurement. It's not, it's weird because it feels like it leans very hard into the horror in those last 10 to 15 minutes. But other than the appearance of the creature, there's not a lot of that earlier on. So yeah, I feel like 5 for fear for me as well. What would you give it for God?
I think this movie leans into its classical style more than it does a richness of theme. And so you know, it's this story has inherent to it thematic considerations, but I don't know that this film is, if it's interested in it, I don't think it gets there. I might actually, maybe just because of how baked in it is to the story itself, I'll go four there. Just, okay. My impulse was slightly lower, but I'll be generous there.
And for me, I actually, so this is what's frustrating. I remembered generally my feelings about this film and the way that it extrapolated the themes inherent in Frankenstein. So I'm going to, before I give my God meter, I'm going to specify this is specific to 1994's Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
No, I get it.
So I'm going to give this a 3. I feel like the film is, as I had mentioned before, I feel like it is terribly impatient. And I feel like it does not, I feel like it is caught up in its production aesthetic. It loves to craft a visual. Like, I can picture the conversation where Kenneth Branagh's like, how long can we make her red dress so that it can flow all the way down these steps? That's a great visual. Yep. And I wouldn't take anything away from
except
that.
Except for production. Her floppy arm, the whole walk. I was like, really?
Yeah. You can't tuck that in.
Right, right. Somebody chop that arm off.
Please. chop that arm off. But I feel like it is so engrossed in that it loses interest in the things inherent in its theme that it could have mined much more richly. So that's why I give it such a low measurement for that. And that means that we give 1994's Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein a 4 out of 10 on the fog meter, which honestly, for the feeling of the film, I think that's right. That feels right to me. But after the conversation we've had, where are you at on this movie?
I mean, I still feel some, you know, compassion towards it. I don't know that I'm like itching to get back to it, but I didn't watch it and feel like, oh my God, what a terrible movie, or, oh, this is so bad, or they made wrong choices left and right. They made some curious choices, but I think if you like the period stylistic high drama of it, it kind of delivers there. And so I don't know. I mean, I think for our purposes, for someone who is just curious, I wouldn't say don't watch it. It's kind of how I might land there.
I think I'm kind of in a similar place where I would, a similar place in the way that if somebody was curious about it, I would say, yeah, go ahead and check it out. That having been said, I think there are much better iterations on the Frankenstein theme. I think this still might be, if you're looking for, well, I want a movie that represents a faithful adaptation of the novel, that gives, you know, a good adaptation of the novel. I do think this is successful at that. I think it fails in many other ways, which disappoints me. I would highly recommend, it's kind of hard to find, but I would highly recommend that 1992 TNT Movie of the Week version where Randy Quaid plays the creature and Patrick Bergen plays Frankenstein. But for this one, this is going to be one that I think it's completely serviceable. And if anybody was very curious to see it, I would be like, sure, see it. Pretty much anybody else, I would be like, there's better versions of this out there. And I am very excited to see where we go with the series specifically. Next week, we are going to go to something that's much more recent. In fact, I think this might be the rare entrant in the Fear of God canon that neither of us have seen as of this conversation. I haven't watched this movie yet. Next week, a film that was released very early this year and has now made its way to streaming. It is a film directed by Zelda Williams, Robin Williams' daughter, and that is Lisa Frankenstein. I believe Diablo Cody wrote the script for it, right?
I think that's right.
So I'm very curious to see kind of what remix they come up with for the Frankenstein model. So next week, check out Lisa Frankenstein, written by Diablo Cody and directed by Zelda Williams. As we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. In that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. Nathan, thank you so much. Listeners, thank you. We will see you all next week.
Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media, essays, an episode archive, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, please consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast. There, you'll unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online event access, and so much more. We want to issue a special thanks to Jacob Hunt of TracerMatula.com for our artwork, also to our assortment of talented musicians, including Andrew Nelson, The Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes, and also to Lee Wright, who helped me, Reed Lackey, write our theme music. Special thanks also to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice, and if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
See you, friend. I mean, friend. You know?
Friend.
Yeah, friend.
Am I your friend or am I not your friend?
Am I your what? Friend? You talking to me?
I'm standing right
you
here.
You talking to me?
Okay.
You put me together?
Yeah.
Where'd this thing come from?
Yeah,
where'd
you take that thing the time. Come from? You can't implant some hair. You take some time. You gonna stitch me up, huh?
But did you fuck my wife?
Like, you give me a big gum, like. Oh, my God. Oh, and cut.
Hi, everybody.